Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 15th of May. The sun is finally shining. It certainly feels like it is anyway down here. There's probably rain in the north somewhere. Not going to affect you anyway, is it, Kev? Well, the US feels like a bit of a distant memory now. You back into the healthier way of living, Kev, now, back in Egypt?
Well, I wish I could say that, but I just had to go and pick something up with my kids, and they insisted that we went to McDonald's on the way home. So, yeah, that's not really very healthy. You know, but what I did was constructively refused to have Coca-Cola with my Big Mac. I had water instead. So step by step, you know, step by step. So we just had Big Mac fries and water instead of Big Mac fries and Coke.
You didn't fancy one of those. You didn't fancy one of those Beyond Burgers or whatever, the new McPlant or whatever it's called.
You reckon you can get one of those in Egypt?
Nobody cares about that.
Why would you want one of those Beyond Mac Burgers in Egypt? It's not meat, is it?
No, it isn't. It isn't real meat. I mean, we ate some meat in the US, though, those fillets on the bone, and also the Chateaubriand we had one night. That was fantastic. Yeah. But it's a bit of a contentious...
Chateaubriand was amazing, wasn't it?
It was good. It's a bit of a contentious subject, though, is meat and the ethics of it right now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically what you've got is you've got a whole load of cows all over the world, and to not put too fine a point on it, they're farting their way to extreme amounts of methane. And this is causing us major problems with the CO2. Plus, we're also having to grow a lot of feed for them to eat to then produce the meat, which when we eat and probably then... Yeah, we do the same thing as the cow then maybe afterwards as well. So,
you know what percentage is of global methane that cows are responsible for? I did a bit of research on this before. It's quite startling, actually.
I don't know. I'm guessing maybe 40, 50%.
Yeah, 40% of global methane is from cows and cattle, 1.4 billion cattle. And then according to some scientists, the methane that cows belch out is, while turning obviously the feed you mentioned into food, is far more powerful greenhouse gases than even the carbon dioxide produced by obviously the burning of these fossil fuels. So it's an interesting one. But if only there were an ethical alternative and substitute to these meat. You know, we've got plant-based ones, but then they're a bit bland and they're not perfect. I wonder if there's anything.
It's not meat, though, is it?
Exactly.
It is plant-based. It's like, okay, if you want to be a vegetarian and you want to eat one of these, I mean, I suppose when I'm asking myself, even asking vegetarian, why do you want to eat a meat burger if you're a vegetarian? I thought you didn't want to eat meat, you know.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about the proportion of people who want to be vegetarians. We're talking about people who are quite happy to eat meat and want to continue to eat meat. So do you know anybody? Have you had any idea what
no idea.
Is there any technology out there?
I'd like a professor to come on and give us some information on this, if possible.
Hello.
Oh, but yep. Professor Shay Connan. 3D Biotissues CEO. How are you, Shay? Welcome.
I'm very well, thank you, Phil. Yep, not too bad.
Good. What can you do? Were we almost on track with that discussion? Do you think we were at some valid points, or was it pie in the sky? Pardon the pun.
No, I think the puns are thick and fast with all these meat alternatives. But no, I think you're more or less on point there. I would just add that perhaps some people are being vegetarians because of their consciousness about the sustainability and the environmental aspects, and they may actually do enjoy meat. So they would be looking for, they would probably happily eat different types of meats and the kind of meats that we're developing at 3D Biotissues.
Correct me if I'm wrong. So I was looking at another company that's obviously in this area, is it Agronomics or Agronomics, who are obviously listed in the UK. And I also think that they've got connections in Holland or somewhere like that. There's a lot of the board appear to be Dutch. They have a cultural meat. So can you tell the difference between 3D Biotissues, the way that the meat is grown, and the way that the Agronomics would do things?
Agronomics is a company that looks to invest into this area, cultivated meat, lab-grown meat. These are the kind of names that are called. So they don't produce any themselves, but some of the companies that they have invested in do. Yeah, very much so. I mean, there is the what's out there at the moment, and there's a few, very few places. Singapore's leading the way in terms of availability of these lab-grown meats, and they're in kind of processed products, chicken nugget, for example, and the ones in the agronomics, as I'm aware of, at least, are focusing on burgers, sausages, things like that. Again, so it's a processed meat product. Where we differentiate is quite a major way, in that what we're creating is 100% meat. So, or as we like to call it, meat as you know it. And what we'd like to do is move this, all the fantastic opportunities and potential in this lab grown meat, move it towards a direct replacement. So move it towards an ingredient that you would use at home and cook and prepare in the same way that you would with the meat you do today, you know, natural meat, we call it, or animal sourced meat. So that's a big point of difference. We're not looking to grow cells to be blended with a whole host of other materials, scaffolds to give it the kind of bite and things like that. Because I think you're going to end up with something that's pretty similar to the vegetarian meats and sausages and things like that. I think a lot of what we enjoy about meat is that texture, bite, and the mouth, as they call it, mouthfeel. And our platform and the platform 3D BioTissues has developed, and the IP behind that allows us to create these exact replicas of tissues. And we're talking about muscle today and meat, but of course we can use that same platform to generate other tissues such as cornea and skin.
If you talk us through the basics, because obviously we could be probably here all day talking about the sciences, which would probably baffle most listeners, because I'm sure there's a lot of technology involved and science involved in it. Is it effectively like a form of printing the meat using the basic DNA? How does it all work?
No, it's not. No, we actually took an early lead back in the university. So the 3D BioTissues spun out of Newcastle University about 3 years ago. And our lab was one of the first to 3D print cornea, the tissue. But we as we were one of the first, or the first actually, we also recognized the limitations of that approach. So we very quickly pivoted and looked towards different technology that we'd also been developing in the lab. So it wasn't completely new. What we do is we ask the cells to do what they would like to do naturally. So in the body, they're there and they're producing tissue to you know, make up for the natural loss of tissue as it ages, etc. And it's there producing more tissue. And we've identified some cues, both biochemical cues and biophysical cues. And that means the kind of the media, the soup the cells sit in, and also some physical poking as well, to push these cells to create, or to make them think that they're inside the body and they're producing tissue, but at the same, with the same structure and function as they would inside the body. So it's cell-based, and we get the cells to produce the tissue, and a lot of that tissue is called extracellular matrix, and that's the main component of the bite and the mouthfeel is what's called an extracellular matrix. It's all these rope-like proteins, chewy proteins that make up the structure of any tissue.
And how close, I mean, how easy is it, and the cost effective is the whole process in terms of, because I know when Agronomics announced, I think a company that they were investing in, was it Meatly or whatever they were called, they effectively started off costing about £250,000 to produce a fillet steak or something like that. I mean, is it something that as you increase is it economics of scale that you can bring the price of a fillet steak down, or a chicken nugget or something down?
Yes, exactly right. It all revolves to meet the price point of today's cost of meat. It's all around scale. And one of the important, or the most expensive parts of that at the moment has been the feed, this cell culture media, the soup that the cells live in and get all their nutrients from. And that's been a real limiting factor, the cost of this, partly because a lot of the technologies come from biomedical research, and a lot of that has always used what we call animal serum. So it's derived as a product, a byproduct of the meat industry. And it's a concentrated form of a whole mixture of proteins and all sorts of things in there. And that's really good and scientists like to use that because it's convenient. They know that cells will grow in it, and then they can do their experiments with the cells and look at, you know, a whole range of different genes or whatever else they're going to look at. But that, so that's ingrained in cell process or the growing of cells. So we've had to remove that for one is the cost, and two, of course, is an animal derived product, which goes against the whole kind of concept and ethos of a lot of the concept and ethos of with the lab grown meat. And that's where 3D biotissues has also taken a lead, in that we already had a program that was initially run in the university, but the IP and know-how has been transferred into 3D biotissues to look at different ways of replacing animal serum in the culture media, in this soup. So that's actually one of our first products. Is what we call CityMix, and it's a supplement you can use to culture cells in, or to replace the animal serum in your soup, in your cell culture media.
So what actually is involved currently with that animal serum then? What parts of the animals are they using to do this? Is it pretty inhumane what they're doing to the animals to get this stuff, or what's the situation?
Yes and no. I mean, it's a part of the animal animal slaughter. So it is pretty grim. If you look at a video on where does fetal calf serum come from, or these serum, where they come from, it's pretty gross. Because, you know, some people might think, well, the slaughter of the animal in itself is pretty gross, but it's not a particularly pleasant process. That's for sure. It's a blood product, basically.
You've managed to replace that with effectively what is yours based upon then?
Yeah, it's based upon, I mean, a lot of our, where we come from from the lab and as scientists is to look at how the body, the animal works, and try to understand and then try to take some of those cues. And we've done that with the platform for growing the tissues. We call it tissue templating, but it's a lot of the cues and the information is gained from how cells grow into tissues in the body. And we've also looked at that when we looked at the alternatives to serum. We've looked at the concentration of protein in biological tissues. So even some of the most dilute tissues, such as blood, they have something like 80 grams per, I think it's 80 grams per liter or something like that. Whereas the media, this cell soup, can be down at kind of 1-2 grams per liter. So a massive difference in terms of just the amount of material in there between what the material cells are normally bathed in and what the cells are bathed in the lab. So our approach is to increase the concentration of proteins around those cells. And we do that using a technique called macromolecular crowding. And it's like if you were in a room and there's a fixed room and you've got 20 people in there and they're all kind of equally dispersed and no one's talking to each other. If you throw in a load of balloons and pack the room full of balloons, then the people maybe ended up being a little bit closer together. And that's the kind of, I don't know if it makes sense or not, but that's what we're trying. That's how our product works. So it basically, without actually increasing or adding any other bioactive material, we can actually get more out of what's already there. Or conversely, you can add other synthetically made growth factors and use them at a much lower concentration. And these tend to be quite pricey. So overall, what we're doing is reducing the cost and the need for animal serum in the culture of these cells. And that's something that we've got a lead on, big lead on, yeah.
So there is no animal part of your serum. Everything in it is vegetarian, if you like.
Yeah, that's it.
So we're using a vegetarian. I mean, ultimately, all I can see is a cow eating grass. Doesn't eat any meat. So it eats grass and then produces meat. So I presume it's the same scenario. I mean, obviously, I'm making it very simple, but ultimately, cow eats grass, grass produces meat, we eat the meat or milk, as the case may be. So is that the similar? even though it's obviously
well, there's an awful lot of biochemical steps between the grass and the meat formation. I mean, they eat grass to get sugars basically, and then the sugars then go on and the protein and then goes on to form the structures. So in the feeding of the cells, you do still need sugars and some other proteins or growth factors to actually make it work. So it's not a case of just water and what our city mix. There are other components, but these are the kind of much cheaper end of the cost of the shopping list on media.
It sounds like a game changer if you've come up with an animal free growth agent that can be used for the meats rather than something that would be seen to be, you know, by the animal rights activists as very cruel and inhumane way of doing things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's we're fortunate to have had that, been working on it for quite a few years prior to the creation of 3D BioTissues, and it was just fortuitous that we were looking at it from a medical for medical purposes of growing cells, because actually, and this is relevant to 3D BioTissues, the move away from serum is not just something that the lab grown meat companies need. It's also something the bigger pharmaceutical companies are doing with cell-for-cell therapy, or what we call biologics, which is like viral vaccine production, things like that. So yeah, it's actually a product that will reach out to quite a few different markets.
So you have actually in your processes now, you have used this stuff and you've grown lab meat.
We've grown very small amounts of lab meat, but in the development process, that's all we needed to prove to ourselves that, you know, things are working in the way that we expect them to be working in terms of around the structuring, and to investigate the structure. We don't need to create kilograms of the tissue as the development goes. That's for the next stage, and that's partly why, of course, we've looked to BSF and this relisting to help with that.
We've got another guest on, Jeff Baker, director of BSF Enterprise. Welcome, Jeff. How are you?
Oh, good, mate. How are you, Phil? And listen, I've been fascinated, I'm always fascinated listening to Shay talk about cell structuring and the next generation of what I call biotechnology and cell-based tissue engineering. It's something that we love so much. We got to know 3D BioTissue, and as a listed company in London on the LSE, we thought it was such a good opportunity in a market we wanted to get into that we entered into an acquisition late last year, and we're now reversing that company back into BSF Enterprise, and they're going to start charging into the future of cell tissue engineering.
You're quite excited about that, I imagine. I mean, it was announced, as you say, on the 24th of December that they'd entered into that conditional share sale. So with obviously for the entire issued share capital of 3D BioTissues. I mean, so I think you suspended it, was it on the 16th of August, pending an announcement. Is it fair to say that BSF is now a SPAC looking into this space, or in the BioTissue space, for investments into companies like 3D BioTissues?
Correct. We're a SPAC, I suppose, almost a shell company. And our first acquisition has been 3D BioTissue, where we've acquired 100%. It's an area we want to enter into, and I think we're living in unprecedented times, apart from all the very strange things that are happening around us. What's happening now in cell and tissue growth is phenomenal, because it's going to revolutionize food production. People don't realize it's coming, but they have to start to take notice of what's happening. And the London Exchange and Europe as well have been a bit slow on the uptake. In America, it's a booming industry called cellular agriculture, or cell ag. And this is something that we all have to come to terms with. And we're hoping, and we believe that it's going to be such a revolution that it will solve food shortages worldwide. It'll reduce greenhouse gases. The cows that Kevin were talking about, and all of that methane that's been, it's certainly not going to increase it. If people start shifting to lab-grown meat products, then we're going to be able to get all these benefits and revolutionise food production. And I think that's the exciting thing for us. You know, 30 years ago, the internet revolutionised information, communication and business. And I see this type of technology revolutionising the food industry and where we're going to go with food production.
Yeah, the benefits of not feeding all these cows the grain is going to release huge amounts of grain to the world to feed the poorer areas of the world. And at the same time, you know, as you say, reduce the methane, which hopefully is going to help the planet as well. So there are some seriously good reasons why we should shift to this. And cellularly, we're talking about exactly the same thing. So Shay, are we talking about, you know, I could decide how I want my fillet steak? So in other words, I want to have a bit more fat in my fillet steak than you know, just the normal plain fillet steak, or I want my Chateaubriand to be a bit longer than the normal Chateaubriand on the cow, you know, because it can only be a certain part of the fillet.
Or you want the finest Wagyu with marble of seven or something like that, you know.
You know, can we do these things? No, I don't mean today maybe, but like down the line, we could actually specify exactly the type of steak we would like in this particular situation.
Yes, I mean that's the hope. That's the hope, or where it could go. Can we do that today? No, we can't. But that's the what we're doing is laying the groundwork, such that you will be able to do those types of things in the future. And as a scientist, what we would call that, Kev, is rational design. So if you can control the growth of a steak, then you can control different aspects of it, like where the fat is, the proportion of fat, how chewy it is. You know, you could have a steak that is a bit like the old Cornish pasty. You could have one that's filet mignon on one side and more rump at the other, or anything in between. So you could do all those types of things. We actually do have, and one of the kind of interesting areas looking forward is about the health benefits of doing this. And I'm not in it to kind of create meat that's another processed, you know, product that's going to add to the obesity epidemic. We want to be able to create meats that have increased health benefits. We've demonstrated that actually you can, by this rational design, by changing some of the structure of the meat, you can actually change the what we call the digestive profile. So putting it through what we call a model gut. So it's a series of test tubes that represent some parts of the digestive tract. We can get data showing that how we design that meat affects the rate of digestion, for example. Now, it's a very early stage, but it's kind of, even at that early stage, indicating that the concept is feasible, that you can engineer in complexities that may affect the way that it's digested and may then also potentially have health benefits moving forward.
It's fascinating. One of the other times when we talked a couple of months ago before this all happened that you were going to list, we were talking basically about your ability to also grow leather. And I was fascinated by this in terms of the high-end handbags and high-end sort of clothing that would be possible through this, even shoes, I suppose, by producing leather. So can you tell us a bit about that and how that's progressing?
Well, certainly, the concept, because of the platform technology that we've developed that allows us to grow a variety of different tissues, these structural tissues, and cornea is one that we've progressed quite heavily. But muscle and meat we've spoken about, but the other one is skin, and of course, skin is if processed in a certain way becomes leather, and there's certainly an appetite for people to move away from animal leather to a lab-grown leather for lots of reasons, actually. One is that kind of back to that environmental aspect. There's the potential that if or rather when the lab-grown meat really takes off, there'll be a pivoting point upon which the cost of traditional meat will actually go up significantly. And at that pivot point, then the cost of leather, which is currently a byproduct of the animal industry, will also go up. So then some of these high-end leather brands and fashion brands are kind of recognizing this as not just in, just for consumer kind of pull, but also the fact that where may their starting material come from in the future. And so, yeah, so the lab grown, we can create these highly organized tissues, such as skin, and we can create a very high quality leather. That's what we believe. And we're getting a lot of interest.
So that could be crocodile skin. It could be any of these like sought after animals, if you like.
Yeah, that's quite right. Yeah. So we can start with different animal cell types. And perhaps make slightly different skin with different mechanical properties, which would then result in leather of different feel and use. Yeah,
Jeff, you've invested lots of money in this company, obviously, and raised money for this. How do you see this company making huge quantities of money in the future? Because that's obviously a fairly strong driver to why you've invested in this company, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, Kevin, as I said, it's the future and it's a great technology to get behind. There are more technologies in and around this space. If you look at the manner in which you have to develop a lab-grown meat, leather-grown and serum-free media, you know, these are elements of the process, but we're looking at other technologies, the bioreactors that are needed, because what you need to get to mass production is that you need a lot of bioreactors that can grow these cells and grow the product. So there's mass production patents and intellectual property and technology that we're looking to go out and acquire as well, and start to build around us a suite of cell tissue structuring technology that will take us into the future.
So is it fair to say then that 3D biotissues is effectively, sorry for calling you this, Shay, but is effectively the cow eating the grass in the field, and you're going to then take it through the process of growing those cells? So in other words, the knowledge and the ability to do it is in 3D biotissues. And then there are going to be further companies acquired to then develop this on a mass basis. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we're not looking to go right down the value line of manufacturing at great mass, as well as then distributing and retailing product, because that's that end of the market is a very mature market already. There are plenty of people delivering meat and leather and other products to the market. We're looking at the top end, where we're looking at developing the technology needed to get the product mass produced and then developed. So yeah, we're looking more at a licensing model and joint venture model with various people that are willing then to go into manufacturing. Yeah. We'll provide the tools, the picks and shovels of the industry.
Would it be safe to say that you've almost got a first mover advantage, in the sense that you are the first listed company in the UK based that are on the standard list main market that are actually doing this or have the technology to do this lab grown meat?
Absolutely. Phil, it's right. We are the first, as far as I'm aware, the first listed company to be looking at this cellular tissue structuring market. Agronomics, you mentioned, they are listed, but they look at as an investor into many different types of this type of technology. But we're building a business in this industry, in this field. And we have got a first mover advantage, although there's a lot of other American companies that are well and truly in front of us. And if you look at the values, Kevin, of those American companies, then you realise that where what opportunity lies in front of us as we develop a similar model. We have a suite of products, not just lab-grown meat, leather, skin. We can produce skin and cornea, as Shay was indicating. But also we have the serum-free media, and we have a skin product, which is a collagen product that provides a wrinkle-free benefits for people seeking to use that. So we're into the cosmetics. We're across a whole array of various industries, and there's not many.
I think I need some of that wrinkle-free stuff, actually, to be honest with you.
Well, Friday night, and I can understand it. That's, I think we all need it.
Is it, I mean, with the serum-free media you referenced, and we've obviously talked about that earlier, would it be again safe to assume that this could be, obviously, is IP? You meant it, I think it's called City Mix or something that Shay mentioned that. Is this something that could be IP'd and then royalties could be brought back in future, to giving it out to other companies that would want to use this for their product?
Well, with the serum-free media, that's a slightly different model that we're using, because we can produce that. It doesn't take a lot to produce the. You can do it in kegs and caskets and get it out pretty quickly. You don't need a lot of it. Although when you get into mass production, you'll need millions of litres. But that we're not there yet, and that's still some years away. But yes, we would then look to licensing it out to other companies that have more. Over in China, I've heard that they're building massive plants to produce serum-free media. So it's not just happening here in the UK, but it's happening right around the world.
Should we talk through some of the numbers then in terms of, so you're going to resume trading on Tuesday, the 17th of May, so this coming Tuesday, is that correct?
Yes, we're off and running.
Yeah, excellent. So that's going to be, obviously, as we mentioned, that's LSE. That's the standard list of the main market. The ticker is, I believe, is BSFA.
Yeah, it's BSFA.
BSFA is the ticker. And market cap wise, is it around the 10 million? I'm not sure. Obviously, I'd need to look at the total number of shares that have been issued since it was suspended. Can you give us an idea of the market cap?
Yeah, it's a bit short of 10 million. It's probably around 7 or 8 million.
Is it around a mark that seems to be a fair value, or even probably under that fair value, right, for the assets and the technologies that it has?
Yeah, it's only small, and we're coming off. We did a very small capital raise as well of 1.75 million. We wanted to keep it all small at this stage to help fund the growth and the development through and further acquisitions through the next 12 months. And we're coming on at just over 7p. per share, so it's not a huge ask, and I think a lot of people will be interested.
Yeah, so for those listeners who fancy taking a look at it, and say ticker's BSFA, so keep an eye out for that one, and if you feel like having an investment, then great.
So now you're going to own 15% or 16% of the overall company. Do you see the value in you put in all of your resources behind this so that it can progress to something that's going to be financially interesting for people?
I'm not sure if I understand the question, actually, Kev, but I think what I'm going to say is that I believe I can add value to this, the BSF. What we're looking at is a highly technical area, and in these early companies, it's as much around the leg, what the legs of the technology are, and do they work, and and also, I've got a good handle on that, so I think I'm going to be useful for a while yet.
So you can see that these things will become easily usable, if you like, in industry in terms of what they need to do.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What is the unique selling point or selling points about the technology you have? What is the thing that turns the light bulb on and says, yeah? That's a company maker,
It's the tissues are identical to the natural tissue. So we're going to be creating 100% meat, or technologies that facilitate 100% meat, or we're growing 100% meat, basically. Meat as you know it. It's not another sausage.
Not another Linda McCartney's out the freezer.
Yeah, I think that's a really big point of difference internationally. And it's
you think even in the States they're not doing this, or they are?
Not that I've known. I mean, the typical approach is to create a scaffold from a variety of different things. It could be, you know, it could be a variety of different things, and then you add the cells to it. But you don't get the density and the organization down at this microscopic level, or even nanoscopic level, that you do find in actual tissues. And that nanoscopic tiny structuring differences are important for function when we're looking at medical devices, and important for taste and texture when you're talking about lab-grown meat.
Jeff, Shay, you're both on the Sunday roast, and we traditionally ask this question: what is a Sunday roast to you? What is your favourite Sunday roast? Jeff, if you'd like to begin.
I hate to say I'm a vegetarian, but no.
It can be roast cauliflower if you want.
Got to be a nut roast then, surely. It's got to be a nut roast.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. You've hit it, Kevin. The roast my wife does of cauliflower with cheese and sauce and all the rest is to die for. I hate cauliflower. My mother used to feed it to me as a child, and it was so wet and soggy that I used to hold it in my mouth until she turned away and I spat it out. But this is fantastic. So if any roast you have, you should always have your roast cauliflower.
Roast cauliflower. And it is quite ironic that you're a vegetarian in this business, but anyway. Shay, what would it be?
I'm partial to any roast, really. But I think when I'm cooking it, I'm really pleased if I manage to get like 100% of the pork skin crackling perfect. Mm. And then I'm a pleased man. Knowing that I haven't wasted any of it and it's all nice and salty and crackly.
You can smack the spoon on it and you can play a tune on it. That's when you know it's working. Yeah. And some applesauce with that, I presume, or not?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And all the other stuff. But that was
the other stuff is right. We'll even throw in the roast cauliflower with some cheese on the top. But it has to be vegetarian cheese. Well, I don't know what that means, but anyway.
Lactose free as well.
Very good.
Brilliant.
I tell you what. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And enjoy your roast this weekend. And we'll speak to you soon.
Professor Shay Connon, CEO of 3D BioTissues. Jeff Baker, Director of BSF Enterprise. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Phil. That's great.
Thank you. Thank you both. Good to meet you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kevin. Phil.
Today, we're also joined by Mike Rolston, CEO of Blencow Resources. Welcome, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I believe you've been on a bit of a whistle-stop tour. I saw on Twitter that you were in Uganda.
Yeah, we finally got to get back there, which is great because we haven't obviously been for a while. But it was fantastic to be back in country to catch up with our team there and to obviously catch up with all the contacts that we've made over there right up to the very most senior level. So it was a very good trip.
Excellent. So you're in London now as well, I believe. Sorry I couldn't make it. Kev and I have been on a bit of a road trip ourselves, so we're a bit manic, but we'll certainly catch up there soon. How's things progressing with, you know, obviously you've talked about the PFS being worked on very hard behind the scenes. How do you think things are progressing there?
Look, I think the PFS is going to be an exceptional result. I really believe that we've pushed towards trying to get a lower CapEx startup than we had in the PEA last year, yet at the same time to try and deliver as good, if not better, net present value. So it's obviously a big challenge to do that, but we've got a lot of things going our way at the moment, and I'm confident that we're going to put out a very, very good pre-feasibility study around about the end of June. That's when we plan to get it out there. So we're still on track, and hopefully we'll get something into the market very early in July.
Brilliant. I mean, looking at the last RNS, the mineral resource upgrade, you know, increased by 50%, 8.1 million tons to 24.5 million tons, 6% TGC. Do you think the market has largely missed that result and not really understood the gravity of how big this is?
Look, it's hard to say. My belief is that, you know, the market doesn't really comprehend or understand what a much bigger resource means. And we really have to put that into numbers, I guess, when we put out this pre-feasibility study that shows, you know, what that means for us is moving from a 13-year mine life to a 20-year mine life. So it's suddenly almost doubled our project size. And it's obviously given us the ability to go ahead and complete this pre-feasibility study because it's been recategorized into indicated and measured resources. So, yeah, it's probably gone a little bit under the radar, but it's a necessary step along the journey. And I think the big line in the sand is going to be this PFS in the next 45 days. And then from there, we're going to be driving towards first production. So it's pretty exciting because I think graphite's going to have a huge day in the sun very soon. And we want to be leveraged, highly leveraged into that when it happens.
I suppose I'm going to ask the question, why graphite? Why is everybody so interested in graphite all of a sudden? I don't get it. Tell me why.
Well, look, there's a lot of uses for graphite, and I won't go into all of them because we could be all day. But the one that's really capturing the market's attention and will certainly continue to is the fact that graphite is a non-replaceable source or requirement into the anode, which is one of the two key components of the lithium-ion battery. And as we know, these lithium-ion batteries are what are going to run the electric vehicles as they expand from about 15 million EVs today towards somewhere over 100 million as predicted by the end of the decade. So each and every lithium-ion battery contains approximately 50 kgs of graphite. And if you start running these numbers towards hundreds of millions of EVs in the future, there's a lot of batteries and a lot of graphite that has to come into the equation. And, you know, everybody's probably understood the lithium component of that battery, the nickel and even the cobalt components, because they all sit on the cathode side, but on the anode is where the graphite comes into play. So I guess the major reason why I'm so confident that graphite's going to have its day in the sun is over $500 billion of investment has gone into 280 odd mega factories that are out there either being built or in the planning stages of getting built ahead. And as soon as they open their doors and start requiring feed coming in, the anodes coming through to build these batteries, graphite demand is going to fly. And when it flies, we're obviously going to see demand exceeding supply, and that will have a lot of ability, I guess, to push the prices up considerably. So there's a moment going to happen. I don't know when. Look, 280 mega factories are not yet built. They're not there with their doors open and doing business. There's probably about 50 of them that are up and running at the moment, but there's another 200 and something that are going to be up and running in the next 1 to 3 years. And when that moment happens, this graphite market is going to absolutely explode.
But surely those guys have already sorted out their graphite, where they're getting it from and whatever. Sure.
Kev, I tell you, everybody is asking me that very same question. And I don't have the answer because I'm not directly talking to them. You know, they're not my customer. I've obviously got to sell into the anode manufacturers, but they are absolutely going to run into a brick wall if they don't source their supply chain and ensure that they have the graphite to fill their demand. So I think the real reason why that hasn't happened yet is that the majority of those mega factories are located in China, and China is still the world's largest supplier of graphite. So effectively, the Chinese bubble exists within China in terms of both demand and supply, and they're okay at this stage. But even China is starting to look outside of China to source supply going forward. And we've seen some big lithium and cobalt deals recently in that line. So, yeah, when the other non-Chinese, and by that I mean North American and European mega factories start to come online over the next 1 to 3 years, they're going to have to source product. And I don't think they're going to get it from China. So they're going to have to source it from somewhere else. And as I say, we want to be in production, looking as attractive as possible to obviously provide as much of that as we can.
So if we took an example of Tesla, who's supplying Tesla's graphite at the minute? And, you know, they're obviously going to ramp up production in the US. I think I saw something Phil posted there that Tesla basically stopped taking orders of cars so far in advance because they've sold everything that they're going to produce, I think, for the next 12 months. So where's their graphite coming from?
Well, Tesla have recently done a deal with Syrah Resources, which is the biggest graphite producer in the world, well, certainly outside of China. And yeah, it's interesting because Tesla, being the biggest EV manufacturer, has now done a deal with the biggest graphite producer. So it tends to happen. The biggest on both sides of that equation come together. But there are going to be plenty more below Tesla. Obviously, they're not the only EV manufacturer, and they're going to be plenty more needing to do the same thing. And they're going to be looking at the graphite producers, and they're going to be saying who's got the quality of the product first that we require, and beyond that, who's got the ability to scale up, and who can we do some deals with. So there's plenty of room for strategic partners and strategic relationships to be formed in the next couple of years. And we're already starting that process. In fact, we've just completed our final stage MET test work, and we've got our technical data sheets going off to various end users to start looking at who might be interested. Not necessarily EV manufacturers, that's too far around in the equation for us, but certainly anode manufacturers and people will be interested to take our product. So it's happening already, but it's going to scale up significantly going forward.
I think the fact is that there's simply not enough in the Western world. As you just said, most of the world's graphite goes through China. So there's going to be significant competition for Western graphite between Western companies. And doing graphite projects, as you say, outside China is very hard to do, isn't it, at traditional commercial level. So do you think that will put the companies, small companies, small junior miners onto the map going forward?
It will, because if you look at the likely logic, it's going to be a lot of companies and factories that are demanding the product, wandering around trying to find where they can source product from, and they will be able to help the smaller junior miners to fund their projects and to bring them into production. But you can't just, even with the money that they may provide, you can't just turn a project on in 5 minutes. It takes years to get these projects up and running. So when they come looking for those supply chain, we want to be one of those projects that's up and running, so that they will obviously view us as being a first port of call, and someone that can actually ramp up and fulfill their demand as they go forward. So, yeah, we're working very hard to be at the right place when that big moment happens and the end users really start getting pretty scared about where they're going to get their supply from and coming looking.
Yeah, so really the fundamentals of this is that there isn't probably a supply deficit right now because most of the production is being used in China. But going forward, there is going to be a supply deficit.
They're talking about a structural deficit as soon as 2023, 24, basically.
Yeah, so within a couple of years, and that's when you're going to be producing as well. So it fits very nicely. Now, we haven't really talked then about the price of graphite, because the price of graphite has gone up a bit, but not a huge amount. So I suppose we're looking at the same sort of story as nickel, copper, lithium, that, the world has suddenly demanded literally that we change to EVs and we change to this greener resource, but we don't have all the resources. So how do you see it playing out over the next number of years, the graphite price?
Well, the first thing I'll say is people claim that obviously as these metal prices go up significantly, as they have already with lithium, cobalt, nickel, etc., they claim that this will make the lithium-ion battery uneconomic because it will just push the price too high. Yet that's not true, because the cost of the actual input materials as a percentage of the overall battery cost is still pretty low. It's around about 20%. And because of the efficiencies in terms of making these batteries as they improve, those costs are actually going down and then being counterbalanced by some metal prices going up. So I don't see metal prices as significantly changing or impacting the demand for the lithium-ion batteries. So it basically means that there's room for these prices to go up and for the demand and use of these batteries to still continue rising. So Now, look, I don't know what's going to happen to graphite prices. I really wish I could tell you. I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm absolutely confident that the exact same dynamic within the market that has pushed up lithium, cobalt, nickel, all these other battery metals will apply to graphite. Just as soon as the demand supply imbalance starts to kick in. And I think that's going to be driven by these mega factories coming online over the next 1 to 3 years. And they're going to be demanding product that is just not there. And that's going to obviously have a huge impact. And we're waiting for that. Obviously, we still want to make sure that our project is viable and feasible and can do very well at today's prices. And it does. But if these prices start to really push up, that just turns it into an absolute world-class project. So that's the hope going forward.
As you move forward, then we're going to have a feasibility study or pre-feasibility study coming out in end of June, early July. That's the plan. And that will give everybody a very good idea of the financials involved in the project with the current graphite price. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that we've really been keen to show within this PFS is we want to de-risk as much as possible. So instead of starting off with some huge plant that's producing a great big quantity that we may not be able to sell all of it up front, and then suddenly you run into the same kind of problem Sire Resources had 3 years ago when they had to close their doors for a while, we want to just start off at a modest position and grow from there. We're going to have a modular plant that we can add further to at any stage, both cost effectively and time efficiently. And we believe that we will end up growing this into a large scale project. But we want to start off a bit smaller, which obviously has a good impact in terms of the CapEx number required for that startup. But most of all, we want to kick off with a stage one pilot plant next year. So we're actually producing some graphite. We're getting pre-qualification into the markets, selling our product to end users. They want to see what we've got. They want to see us consistently deliver it. They want to see the quality have that consistency, ISO standards, et cetera. And that's what we'll do. So that by the time this 1 to 3 year impact starts to happen, hopefully we'll have been producing and selling graphite for a little while, and we'll be able to react to it going forward.
The elephant in the room, we're currently at 4p, you raised it 5p, currently sort of 6.5 million to 7 million pound market cap, which for the amount of resource you have and the stage that you're at seems very cheap, basically, in terms of your market cap. What do you think about that?
Oh, look, I agree with you. I mean, it's massively undervalued. It's undervalued even if we're just an explorer. As a project that has a 21-year mining license in our hands already, that'll be driving from this PFS through into production next year, with what's happening in this particular space, in this market, and the potential for the price rises, as we've talked about, it's a crazy low valuation. And I don't really know, I don't really know why. I guess we've obviously got to work that out and address that. Part of it is just getting out there and selling this message that we're doing right now. And that's why I'm in London. But the other part of it, I guess, is there's a little bit of nervousness in the market as a whole at the moment. It's obviously impacting everybody. But we've just got to keep driving on and doing what we're doing and believe that the market will understand the fundamentals. Because they've seen it happen with lithium companies. They've seen it happen with nickel companies and cobalt. So there's no reason why they won't be able to see it happening with us as well going forward.
I see that you as a company, you're doing everything right. So tell us a little bit about what happened in Uganda when you visited recently.
Well, we went there really to just, re-establish the relationships with everybody, including our own team. Obviously, we've all been existing on Zoom for so long. And also to establish the relationships with the government and the people that matter in terms of their support. And we sort of highlighted that with a big presentation to about 20 very senior people, including ministers and permanent secretaries and heads of financial and other departments, mines departments. So it was all incredibly well received, far better even than I thought. It highlights to me what all the ministers are saying, that they want to see the Ugandan mining industry grow. And they see the Orem Cross Graphite Project as a real flag bearer for that. So we've got some very important, I guess, support at all levels. We were unable, unfortunately, to meet the president, but we met one of his most senior aides, and he's also expressed his support. So we're very happy with what we've got. We've also built a nice, a very capable and experienced management team out there who's doing some good work on the ground. And we're about to kick off our work on this Akila Congo nickel project that we brought in a few months ago with our first airborne electromagnetic surveys that will be happening next week. So they can see that we're serious, that we're doing our jobs, that we're adding value, we're spending money, and they regard us as a very serious company, which is good because obviously the support of the government is vital. And I think that support will continue to grow as we start to put bricks and mortar on the ground from next year and start to go into production. So it's all gone really well. I think we've got a couple of benefits and things that have come out of that trip, including the fact that we're going to be applying for special export zone status, a license to basically be a direct export zone company. And that gives us a lot of tax benefits, a lot of other benefits in terms of customs clearance of products, et cetera. So a very, very worthwhile trip. I always enjoy going there. Uganda is a fantastic place. And yeah, I'm very excited about what we're going to do there going forward.
Very good. Look forward to coming and seeing the graphite in the ground one day then, maybe. We will see.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's literally at surface, so you can see it on the ground if you do go there. But more importantly, we want to see it concentrated into a 96-97% and sent out of the country to an end user. The first one of those that happens will be a massive landmark for the company. We've only been going for 2 years. We bought this project in April 2020. So yeah, we've done a lot. And obviously, times have been a little bit challenging in that period. But, you know, we've got a sort of very tight structure. We don't spend crazy money and silly things. We're all very sort of conscious of making sure that all the money that we get, or most of the money we get, goes into the ground, goes into the project. And it's telling. We're starting to kick some goals. And, you know, as I say, this PFS will be the big line in the sand that visibly shows that to the market.
Mike Rolston, CEO of Blencar Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, gents. Nice to speak to you again.
So how are you feeling then after our lovely road trip? I still feel a little bit jet lagged. I must admit this in the afternoons, I've been starting to doze at the desk and thinking, I woke up one morning, I think about 3 a.m. and just could not get back to sleep. I was on America time zone. So yeah, I'm getting better now, but I don't know. How are you feeling?
No jet lag, just extra travel for me. Obviously back here, took a whole day, but yeah, back to normal. Good to see the kids and my wife. And yeah, it was an adventure and a half. And I mean, we finished it off really with the mast visit that we went to the site there in Piebridge. That's right.
Piebridge in Derbyshire. It's just on the border of the Peak District, or in the Peak District, but you know, very close to some of the most beautiful scenery that you could probably see. So this side of the Lake District, really, for me. So it's certainly some place I've always enjoyed visiting to go, you know, to go on walk. But I mean, one thing that struck me about it is how efficient the operation was. I mean, if people who don't know, Mast Energy Developments are a listed company on the main market, and they basically are a reserve power company, and which that's basically gas peaking, battery peaking, where gas energy is converted into electrical energy and put back into the national grid. Okay, and it's done on a kind of like an auction basis, and it's based on the on the markets. You can probably explain more about how they know when to the peakers to fire up and things like that. It's all to do with demand and prices. But ultimately, we visited Piebridge, we met Louis, we met Bruce, who was the site manager, and we had a look around the engines. What did you think of them? I mean, I was quite impressed with how efficient and how automated the whole process was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the right word to use, isn't it? It's totally and utterly automated. No people on site. As such, everything is remotely controlled. All the information feeds from the site to computers. And, just what I saw was a big money-making machine in a big box. And, I mean, I know that's very... simplistic way of putting it, but there's a big metal box there And I mean, when I mean big, I mean the size of a warehouse, basically. And it's set into three sections. And in each one of those sections, there's a big engine. And the engine basically, as Phil says, takes the gas in, converts it to electricity, and the electricity is pumped into the UK grid. And the UK grid basically has got ups and downs, obviously, whether high demand or low amount of green electricity being produced, whether that be by wind or sea or by the wind farms, then there needs to be something that is able to stabilize this. And that's basically what Mass does. So Pybridge is the one site that they have now, which is completely up and running and paying, obviously, money from the contracts. They bought it at £2.5 million. And I think conservatively, it's worth £5 million today. They've two more sites, which should take them up to £20 million. There is delays because of the big items that are being delivered. But there's no way. I think the market cap's £7.5 million now or something. And when all three sites are going, which will be within a matter of months, I would imagine, you're talking, a market capitalization of just the things they have, the value, never mind the revenue that they're producing, is going to be worth £12 to £15 million.
Yeah.
I mean, market cap's about half of that.
Beggar's belief. I mean, they're at 3.7p or at 3.7p at close on Friday, and they are, you know, they went to market around about, I think it was a 12 pence mark a year ago, just over a year ago, because it was an annual, you know, the birthday was in April. So how have they dropped so low when they've got, you know, a site operational, as you say, that they're aiming for 20 megawatts, which will, I think we did the maths on each megawatt is worth £500,000 of revenues to them, right? That's what we were working on, isn't it? Roughly five.
No, £500,000 capital value. The revenues are less than that, but
right, I meant cap value. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that's £10 million on 2020, yeah, without any further growth.
Yeah, without anything else, and as you say, they've got ambitions to get, I think it's 70 or 80 online as well, another, you know, by the end of next year. And their actual, if you look at the prospectus, I think their target for, I don't know, is it 5 to 8 years, is something like 300 megawatts. So that's their ultimate goal.
Yeah. And I mean, it's going to be a snowball, isn't it? It's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy once this all starts. And I mean, the snowball has started effectively. They've got one up and running. It's producing income. I think the income is around £1 million plus a year. So, you know, you're going to have, when the three go up, maybe £2 to £3 million a year in revenue for a company that's currently worth £6 or £7 million. And you've got assets that you can also sell,
yeah,
for probably upwards of £10 to £12 million, maybe higher. We don't know. But I mean, and there is about a 50, 60 megawatt pipeline that they're basically negotiating now for both the gas peakers and also batteries. So yeah, I'm going to write something up and put some photographs in and stuff that we did. So that'll probably come out next week. But yeah, I mean, the market's an absolute disaster at the minute. Obviously, people are risk off completely, but this is a total non-risk investment in my view. This is like electricity, it's utility, it's, you know, just building a utility platform that's then just going to produce annuity type income for however long. Like I openly admit I own it. It's in my pension and it's going to stay in my pension because it's just, I think it's just going to produce assets and then income as time goes by,
yeah,
or increase and then income.
So what else has been, a highlight this week? I mean, there's been a few good RNSs that have come out. Some but predominantly haven't moved the market as we would expect them to do. I think Ark Minerals was one, wasn't it, that they had a large investment or potential investment JV with Anglo American on their copper cobalt project. I mean, there's been a few like that, haven't there, that just haven't really moved the dial. I think the other one was Technology Minerals, that we interviewed Robin Brundle when they got their EA approval at their site. Yeah. Tipton, and that really just didn't really move the dial, did it? Normally you'd expect to see a bit of an uplift in these things, but in this current climate, it appears It's just not moving. It did
move it. And the same with Ark Minerals. It did move it, didn't it? It moved maybe 15% up and then all the way back down again. So people were just buying on the basis this was happening and then out again. Or it seems that way anyway. I mean, Ark Minerals is an interesting one, but it's over quite a number of years, isn't it, that this is going to be in. Whereas Technology Minerals, this is imminent. Like this is June, July. You know, they were saying June, let's say July for the sake of argument, you know, there's going to be cash dropping into their bank account. And that cash, as this plant gets up and running, is only going to get bigger. And this is just the old style batteries, isn't it? The lead iron ones.
Yeah.
And there's still the news to come for the lithium ion battery factory as well. Yeah. And, you know, there just isn't enough of, I mean, we keep saying there isn't enough of everything, but there isn't enough of the ability to regenerate these things. You know, there just isn't the ability. Nobody has it anywhere in Europe, I think, to the old batteries, yes, but not in this way, because this is a totally hands-off way that doesn't affect humans in the way that they used to have to smash the batteries open and all the rest of it. This is all done mechanically, I think, inside the process. And the same for the lithium ion. The lithium ion is a dangerous battery by all accounts for humans to be involved in. But in this cellular structure of a platform, basically they sort them out without human contact, and then the sludge or whatever you want to call it comes out the other end and can be sold as a paste in the iron one. I'm not sure what we're going to call it in the.
Well, there was a black mass, wasn't there? It was referred to as before. There was a black mass.
That's right. Maybe it's black mass that's coming out of the lithium iron ones. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, basically that share price has gone from 5.5p down to 3p on the basis that this was being delayed. And now it comes and there's a simple reaction and then straight back down again. So that just doesn't make any sense. I mean, with all the assets they have also in the mining situation and also the two plants, which are probably almost certainly going to be EBITDA positive by the end of the summer, probably. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
I see this one as being multiples of it, you know, like into the 10 to 12 yeah. to 15p. And once the market wakes up and realizes just how important this is, you know, as you said, there's a deficit on all of these, but you know, 22% of the minerals required for these batteries is coming from the recyclables.
But there isn't any recyclable plants.
No, exactly. That's what I mean. So they need that extra 22% to cover that deficit, right? That's going to cover a large deficit.
Yeah. So, and you know, I think the real story here is not to buy this and think you're in it just for a short-term gain, because basically what they're going to do is they're going to put one of each type of factory out there every year for the next 3 years, I think it is, at least.
Five and five.
So there'll be up to 10 of these factories, and the income from each one of these factories should be in the multi-millions from each one. So, you know, you only have to do the maths there. And let's say very conservatively, it's £5 million of profit from each factory. 10 factories, £50 million. Market cap's not even close to that at the minute. I mean, I think it's about £35 million. Plus, you've got the value of the land, which is, you know, one of them's already valued at £9 million because they've just sold 10% of it for £900,000. So there's so many sort of factors to this that add to this. I can see it being worth several hundred million pounds, this company, in the next 3 to 5 years. So is it a good... Again, we're talking about risk, aren't we? We're talking about, is this one of those things that can happen or not happen? Not really. It's going to happen, especially now you've got these EA things sorted out. Even the government's talking about having some of these things not have to have as strict environmental assessment as other stuff, because it's part of the green economy. Now, if that happens, the speed of these things and the way they can be done will be, you know, increased rapidly. Because HUI was also part of that situation as well, wasn't it? That thing in Ireland as well.
Yeah, there was some speculation, wasn't there, between Powerhouse Energy and a kind of like a JV or some sort of partnership, that they had to, both companies actually issued a statement saying they note the online speculation. So that was an interesting one. But yeah, I mean, that looks like I saw that HUI had been to Tipperary and were looking around the site and everything. So that there was obviously a site visit going on there from Alexandra. That looked very interesting. Looks like things are moving in the background. So that's very promising to see that. One thing this week that was very interesting, or last week, was on Tuesday, Ben's Creek, just out of the blue, just decided to lose 25% of its value just for the fun of it. You know, it was not very nice, but it was interesting because, you know, we saw it drop in, and then it suddenly, you know, it was almost like you get the series of stop losses triggered. You know, people are obviously, you know, are very emotional about it. It caused the usual emotions, but ironically, it moved back and ended up higher on the day than it did when it actually, you know, than when it started. So it was just a proper drop on that one. And, you know, almost like the old classic tree shake. And you're going to get people listening going, oh, they're coming out with all the cliches. But it really was just a raid, an orchestrated raid on it. Whether it was short positions being covered and margin calls, I don't know. It's all speculation and we'll never find out. But the best thing about that was the following day, there was a director, RNS, that came out saying that David Harris, non-executive director, had taken the opportunity to load his SIP and load his ISA. And, you know what I mean? Yeah. Fair play to him, because, you know, I bet there's a lot of people who sold out or got panicked into that situation and shouldn't have been doing what they did and selling. They should have been doing what he was doing and buying.
And having been there, we know. I mean, this is, can't say rock solid, it's coal solid. You know, it's the trains are going to be going very shortly, I would imagine. And this is going to be first revenues, or first big revenues, because the revenues are actually applied as soon as the coal hits the ground. Once it's clean, they're receiving just shy of $100 a ton as soon as it lands on the ground. But then when the train goes out with it, they're going to get the remainder of that. Yeah, there was some news for Chilbrands as well this week, wasn't there? They had the general vote to pass the financing scenario, and a bit of an update, which is more news than Chil have had in probably a year and a half. So there was a bit of an update about what was going on, and there was going to be a valuation of Chil.com and different things. We're hoping to actually have the CEO on the roast next week. Callum's traveling to Colorado for a couple of weeks, and hopefully we're going to have our roast from Colorado next week, with more updates on what's happening with Chil as well. So I'm looking forward to that. It's obviously at a multi-annual low at this moment in time, but now it's going to be cashed up and ready to go. And I suppose in this market, if it's got cash and got a chance to progress, then it's got a good chance, I think, because the market itself is absolutely desperate. And I mean, I've had this discussion with a couple of people. I just cannot believe the strength of the US dollar. It's just bizarre. You know, 105 on the indices on the US dollar for all currencies. It's as strong as it's been in a long, long time, like 20 odd years. And yeah. There's no rhyme or reason, because
I think the
US economy is more indebted than it's almost.
Yeah, but I think what's
ever been in its life.
Problem is that you've got, because Bitcoin has been absolutely decimated. It's plunged, say 20% or whatever it is in the last, I don't know, week and a half, two. You know, it's the lowest it's been for the last couple of years, pre-pandemic, or just as it was pre-pandemic. And I think that the money from that is that's strengthening the dollar, because, you know what I mean? Not that there's a correlation, but I do feel that there's some of the value has now moved into the velocity of the dollar. But one thing that interested me was Coinbase are obviously saying now, aren't they, that it's got like 98 million customers, that they may lose all of their crypto if the company goes bankrupt. And that's causing a big, even more of an exit, isn't it? Exit stage left, when bang, is you have an announcement like that. What are you going to do? You're going to want to get your money out, aren't you? You're going to want to, you know, how do you get out of cryptocurrency? It's not the easiest of things to do, is it, to get your money out of crypto and actually realize it into a fiat currency? So I think that's causing a lot of this sell-off on crypto. One of the coins fell 98%, one of the more popular coins. I don't purport to be a a crypto expert, but I know there was a couple of coins that really did lose a lot of the value. The sad part is people are getting margin calls, as you say, and there's also worry about them, you know, losing their houses. I've heard of reports of people on Reddit. It's a sad situation.
No, it's a sad. I mean, you're looking at Bitcoin in dollar terms, 30 to 31,000. You know, I suppose you're also looking at that from a US dollar strength point of view, that anyone who bought Bitcoin using British pounds will have probably paid a lot more than that for them as well, because the pound was stronger. So, you know, to transfer that back into pounds now is going to be even a big hit in that way as well. It could be 20, 30, 40% hit on just the exchange, because you bought the Bitcoin in dollars stroke pounds. Because, I mean, it's positive currency is obviously in dollars, I think. Anyway, yeah, so there is a lot of instability. And I mean, the small caps have been smashed, and there isn't good reason for most of it. I wish I could be super positive and say I can't see anything but it bouncing back. But what I have said to you before as well is that I really do see that the things that are solid, and by solid, I mean, you know, resource-based, they actually have things, whether it be copper, whether it be gold, whether it be silver, whether it be coal, whether it be whatever. These things are effectively, in my view, not going to go down in value. They're going to go up in value. We're in a very inflationary period. They're going to go up in value, and just to maintain their value, if you understand what I mean. So that's where I'm sitting at. Anyway, I really do think that those things are going to do extremely well when everything settles down. But yeah, we're in for a rough ride, I think.
It's been quite a quiet time on the market. So kind of a moment for reflection and just looking at fundamentals. Because like you said, if you find a company that's got solid fundamentals, that's potentially close to revenues, then it seems like a good place to be. But when will we see some of the value come in? Hopefully soon, you know, because we've been saying it for so long. That a lot of these miners, a lot of these resource stocks that have got, you know, very good assets and projects should see some value come through. I mean, the FTSE is not exactly, it's not like when, you know, the times just when the pandemic was announced, where we saw the FTSE down in the 4,000s, and, you know, we're into the 7,300 mark. So the FTSE is actually doing well. It's just sentiment seems to be shot for these really small nano cap companies on the AIM and the sort of standard list. So, yeah,
and on Friday the FTSE was up over 2%. You know, it's gone into the 7.4s, and the Nasdaq and the S&P and the Dow all up on Friday. But at the end of the day, that was like a slight uptick from a terrible week, basically. So you know, but S&P over 4,000 still. It's not like it's bombed completely. I mean, it's below where it was a year ago, which is an interesting fact. You know, it was up at 4.8.
I mean, they're saying that the dollar strength is explained by the market's pricing in the Fed's reserves resolve to control inflation through tighter monetary policy measures. So in other words, as they increase the interest rates, people are going, well, they're looking after this. They're looking after the dollar. Do you know what I mean? And that's looking after the price, which is an interesting one, because it makes you wonder how long they can go on massaging the dollar, if that makes sense, or massaging the life into it.
No, I don't think they can much longer. I mean, I think a good way to look at some of the stocks that have been, or the stocks in general that have been battered in the last week to 10 days, is look at the stuff that hasn't really gone down very much, because probably that means there's a bit of strength there. And when the market and the liquidity starts to drip back in, they're probably the stocks that are going to keep on going, if you like. I mean, I've looked at Conroy Gold, has come down a little bit, but really been steady all week and moved up a bit this last week. And yeah, Chill hasn't moved, but there's been news in that. Benz Creek's been pretty solid. So, you know, there are a few there, and there are many more as well to talk about. So, yeah, it's interesting times.
Well, on that note, I guess we'll say goodbye, and thanks everyone for listening. See you next week.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.